Hi, everybody. I'm an addict. My name's Bart.
Hey, Bart.
And I've been clean since February. I've been clean since February 2nd of 98. And that wasn't the clean date I had planned. I was going to quit on the day after New Year's. And with me, like, you know, I'll quit tomorrow, lasts at least 30 days. So, and it's not my first clean date. My first clean date was October 3rd of 1979. And I was 22 years old, and I had been loaded for 11 years. I only used twice, once for 11 years, and then the next time for 18. But at 22, shit was bad enough that I thought, well, you know, maybe I ought to, you know, do something that might have something to do with the drinking and drugging I'm doing. And I went to a treatment center in Minnesota, and back then, the original fellowship was where they sent us and everything like that. And they were just beginning to really look at addicts and stuff. And because most people thought addict and they thought junkie. And I'm an addict. I love everything. I like, you know, if my drug of choice, they asked me that question and I was real confused because I thought, like, I got to pick one. I like them all. So the qualifications of being an addict is not the fact that once I'm loaded, I stay loaded till I can't stay loaded anymore. And it's not the amount of drugs I use or the kind of drugs I use. The thing that makes me an addict is I knew from early childhood that it was much easier to seek forgiveness than permission, and it's a lie sounded better than the truth, and that the only way to take away the pain in life is take something to numb it. Whether it be alcohol or whatever else you can get your hands on, cough syrup, car sick pills, it didn't matter. And at a very young age, I had that shit all figured out. I got hit by a car when I was 13, and back then they didn't understand about kids and pills and stuff like that. And they gave me a bunch, and all I wanted was a lot more of them. And they were good pain pills. They don't even give them out anymore. But you know, doctors don't think of somebody working them for a script, right? And a kid can say to the doctor, yeah, I got that prescription. It was in my pants. My mom washed them. It's gone. And they would write you a new script with no thought about it. Till about the fourth time you try it out. And I had this shit figured out by the time I was 12. And all I knew was that the one thing I did not want to be, I wanted to be high every day from now on till the day I died. That was my goal. And so by the time I was 22, I'd gone through life. I, you know, get married because it's a thing to do and stuff. So I got married at 19, and that's what adults do. And I mostly liked the illicit drugs. But if they weren't available, drinking was a good second, you know. And as long as there was something, it didn't matter. And that the more people I met that did more different stuff meant I got more different stuff to experience, you know. I'm a member of the Just Say Yes generation. I mean, I started using it in 1968. And stuff wasn't like it is now. I could mow a lawn for $5 and I could go get a whole bunch of LSD at 25 cents a hit. And what would determine the drug I would use was how much money I had and how long I could stay fucked up behind it. Didn't know about the expensive ones like cocaine and all that kind of stuff then. And I wasn't an elitist. I was a garbage junkie. I mean, I didn't shoot dope, but I did everything but that. And I didn't consider myself an addict because I didn't shoot with a needle. And by the time I was 22, I was damn near dead from drinking and drugging. And I had a bottom, and I thought, okay, you know, maybe it's the drugs. I'll give it a shot. I'll try and quit. And my goal was to get 1 year. And so I went to the meetings. I didn't do any steps. My sponsor just taught me how to play cribbage, and I waited out that year. And 3 months before that year, I knew I could get to the year. That was my goal. And so in less than a year, my mind told me that previous 11 years was just a phase I was going through. Now that I've been clean for a year, it'll be different this time. At least now it's legal for me to do the stuff I've been doing for all these years. And if I can just limit myself to beer, pot, and the occasional mushrooms, it'll probably be better than the last time. And that's what I was going to do. And for the 3 months, I didn't go to meetings. I started collecting party favors. And when I got that 1 year, I went to that meeting that I started at. I got my 1 year thing, and I told them, fuck you, don't need you in my life anymore, thanks anyway. And I started using the next day. And I kept thinking, well, I'll just quit when it gets bad. But the problem is that I was damn near dead at 22, so I don't know what bad is. An OD doesn't scare me. I did my first OD in junior high. And so I never know when it's bad enough. The law knows when it's bad enough. The medical community knows when it's bad enough. The psychological community knows when it's bad enough. I don't. That's part of me being an addict. And so I took off using again for 18 years. And I knew that there was a solution, but I didn't want that solution. And I finally got to where I could not use anymore. And I had done everything that I hadn't done yet, I had done. The only thing I did not actually do in active addiction was kill somebody. And other than that, I did it all. And I am just lucky that that's not what happened for me, too. It's not like I didn't want to. So I found myself strung out, torn up. I normally am a fairly healthy guy, usually weigh around 200 when I'm healthy, 250 when I'm not. And I came into this deal weighing 124 pounds. I was a walking skeleton. Some people remember me from back then. And I thought I had Alzheimer's because I couldn't remember shit from one day to the other. And I thought I was permanently going to stay this way. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to stay clean. And if this is the best I get out of the rest of my life, it's a lot better than what I got going on. And oddly enough, say my disease is named Lefty because it always comes up with this weird shit from off in the left field. And my disease told me that the best thing for me to do was to go to Third Ward and get clean. Yeah. So I did. At Riverside Hospital, Barbara Jordan Hospital. And my family had used up all those resources, so what they said was, well, we'll drive you over there, we'll drop you off, and then you're on your own, and don't contact us till you get 9 months clean. And because that's what this disease does. If there's something you care about in your life, this disease puts a wall between it to where you will never have that in your life again. The disease does not want you miserable. It wants you alone, miserable, and hurting so bad that that's all you got to share with people. Yes. And I thought I knew who I was. And this disease created a persona that walked in these doors. I didn't know that because I didn't have any recovery. So when I finally hit that point of powerlessness to where I was no longer going to do, if I thought it, that was the last thing I was going to do. And prior to that, it was, if I had the thought, I might as well just do it and get it over with, and then I'll pick it up later on. And so I got willing. I got surrendered. They couldn't take me into the hospital. They gave me a sandwich, and they said, come back tomorrow. Maybe there'll be a bed, you know, and stuff like that. And they did that for 3 days. And I stayed. There was a little bridge at Waco, and I just crawl up underneath there and wait till the next morning and get up and go sit in the waiting room, hoping they got a bit. And on the third day they did. You know, they came up to me and go, do you still want to get clean? Because I was detoxing hard by then. I couldn't stay awake. I was just all over the place. And a bed came open. And they said, you know, if you want to do this, you can do this. But this is not a love you, hug you treatment center. This is, if you don't get your ass up out of bed, then if somebody else wants that bed more than you, you will be gone. Because it's not costing you nothing. And so I thought, yeah, that's it. That's what I want. I don't care. They said, we don't care if you're detoxing or what. You're going to get your ass up and you're going to go to meetings. Period. Or else, get out. I said, okay, that's great. That's the kind of love I needed in my early recovery. When I would go to a meeting and start to share, they'd say, whoa, if we want to hear from disease, we'll ask you. Till then, shut up. You don't got a thing to share with anybody other than the disease. And I was a little bit hurt by that. You know, my ego told me, well, hell, don't you know who I think I am and stuff? But at the same time, I didn't know who I was. So I finally kicked around, miserable in recovery, long enough that I got willing to get a sponsor other than me that would tell me the truth, not what I wanted to hear. Because I can take the truth and I can twist it to where it just fits me fine and don't know that that's what I'm doing. So I got an outside person that I felt, okay, I can tell this guy the truth, I can tell him anything, and he is not going to take my shit and run around. And the way I did it was I had an acid test figured out in my head. It's like, I'm going to tell this guy that I like to have sex with animals, and then I'm going to leave it alone. And if somebody in one of these rooms comes up to me and says, dude, you sick, then I know, one, that's not the guy from being a sponsor to me, and two, I don't have to worry about it because I didn't do it. And so there's no harm. No. That's the kind of crazy crap that my brain comes up with and stuff. So I got to this. I got to tell you that it's important for me to see Hackness, because I got out of that Riverside, and I still remember the chant we used to do every night. Every day I don't use, it's a good day. And I literally, sometimes that has been the only thing that kept me clean that day. Was if I don't use, it's a good day. But I got out of Riverside, and they had passes for us to go to Hackney. And I think this is like, I don't know, Hackney 8 or 5 or something, I don't remember. But I had never been around clean people that much. They had it over at the Galleria, and I showed up over there, and I remember having tears because I'd never seen like 300 people not using dope all at once. You know? Blew me away. And I said, okay, that's it. I gotta get involved in this. This means the life of me. And my ego was so fucked up that I thought, well, I'll just try it for a while. I can always go back where I was. And this disease will tell you, hey, come on back. This time, it won't be as bad as last time. If you just do this, you'll fix it. Well, I had a sponsor that told me that whenever that motherfucker starts talking to me, that I need to call him and tell him what I'm thinking. And so I did. And he would do stuff like, really? That sounds odd. Look it up in the book and call me back. And I'm going like, the book? He goes, the Narcotics Anonymous basic text. Crack it open, read about obsession, and then call me back. And I'm like, God damn it. He's making me read stuff I don't want to read. You know, this is a trick, you know, and stuff like that. And I don't like to read junk like that. I'll read cartoons, but that's about it. And I started feeling relief, you know. And so I quit calling him as often as I did. But he bit it off because he said I could call him anytime. And I used that like nobody's business for the first 2 years. And then he said, I might not answer right when you call. You can call any time and leave me a message. If I don't answer, I will call you back. But for the first 2 years, 3 o'clock in the morning, when I had that obsession and I couldn't go to sleep and I just needed to tell somebody, I would call this guy and he woke up and would talk to me for about 5 minutes or so, then he'd go on back to sleep. Because he was a guy that went to a job on a regular basis, and he got up at 4:30 in the morning, and he went to sleep around 9 o'clock at night. As soon as he got home from meetings, it was pretty much go to bed. And so all the rest of the time was spent by sponsees calling him at odd hours. And he never complained. He's never asked me to do anything that he didn't do. He's never asked me to do anything that he wouldn't do with me, you know. He gave me a schedule, and he said, you don't know your home group until you've been to every meeting in this schedule. So I need you to go to every meeting in this schedule, and then you come back and tell me which one feels the most like home to you. And that was kind of a tricky way of getting me to know where all the meetings were, so that when I did the phone line, I could tell people how to get there, because I knew, because I've been lost, you know. And I came here from Arizona. I had never been to Houston before. My parents lived here. And I came for a funeral of my grandmother. And it was because my folks had said, hey, I don't know if you want to come out or not, but we'll give you a plane ticket if you want to come see your grandma. And I did want to, you know. When I got off the airplane, my sister took a look at me and says, let me see your arms. And I showed her, and she hit me in the guts right there in the middle of the airport, doubled me over. And I thought, well, she's so pissed. I thought she was wanting to, like, share, you know, and she was upset. And she goes, you dumbass, you're going to kill yourself. And I thought, well, you bitch, you know. And I'm sitting there with the family doing the funeral thing, and I can barely stay awake during the funeral and stuff like that. And then I kicked it hard for a couple of days in the hotel, and that's when I came up with I told my folks, hey, I want to do something. They said, well, we'll take you over to this hospital over here, but that's it. And that's how that all came about. And I know today that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Right? Because the other option was stay in Arizona and get arrested about every 2 or 3 weeks and get fed up. And, you know, I mean, I'd go to jail for a time out to, you know, then get built up a little bit so you could hit the ground running again. And I'd become numb to that shit. First time I went to jail, that was a big damn deal. Seventh time, no big deal. First time I got in a wreck, drunk, big deal. Fifth time, it happens. That's what this disease does. It takes traumatic stuff and it becomes mundane. And other people are like freaking out about it, and you're like, no, I got it. It's gonna leave a mark, but you know, it's not a big deal, you know. And all that whole time, I got this loving higher power that's looking out for me and carrying me through this stuff and waiting patiently for me to finally, like, pull my head out of my ass enough to see that I'm doing some damage to me and I'm the only one doing it. It's not the other people. It was always the relationship, the job, you know, and all that. It was always everything else but me doing it to me. And that's what happened when I was doing like step two and step three. Step one, I finally got an idea that I did not like what I was seeing in the mirror, and the only one that was going to change any of that shit was going to be me. Because I had patiently waited for the rest of the world to come to my way of thinking to the point that that was not going to happen. And I was in a meeting and somebody says, well, if you don't feel close to a loving God, who do you think moved? And I thought, probably me. And he goes, and then who do you think needs to move? Probably me again. And so that was the beginnings of me starting to get an idea of something that loved me and cared for me better than I was. And why wouldn't I want to turn my thinking and my actions over to something that cared about me and wanted me to do good? Why did I always turn my actions and my thinking over to something that wanted to destroy me on a daily basis? That seems a little insane. So some of that insanity got lifted in step two enough that I could recommit, resurrender, and say, okay, that's it. I'm gonna move forward on these steps. I did not want to do a fourth step in the worst way because I couldn't stand the shit that was in there. I sure as hell didn't want to tell another soul. That was all shit I was going to take to the grave. But I learned that sometimes you got to step out in faith. You got to reach out and you got to do it as if it's going to happen, because if you don't, you won't like what happens if you don't. And you just step off in faith. Oddly enough, I have not had anybody in these meetings chase me down the street shooting at me and cussing that they're missing, but in this disease I have. I like the meetings. I like the coffee. I like the hugs. I hated that idea of don't use between meetings. Show up to a meeting every fucking day. Do the steps. You know, I liked to cherry pick my recovery, and it didn't work real well. At 2 years clean, I was pretty miserable, and it was time to make more change. And that's because even though I'd done a fourth step, I didn't do a fifth step. I didn't tell my sponsor that shit. I just went and found a stranger and blah, 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 unloaded all my guilt crap and stuff. And that stranger thought, yeah, sounds good. You know, give him $5 for some booze and leave him alone, and you know, life was good. And so I just, that's what I did. Picked a homeless guy and made his day better. And I didn't get the relief out of it that I needed, because I didn't get the closure. I didn't get the solution. And that's when I was reading in this book, and it says that honesty is the antidote to my disease thinking, and the solution is in these steps. I'm like, shit. Okay, so 2 years clean, I'm only a third of the way through them. I think I might need to step it up a bit. And I called my sponsor again, and I said, hey, man, you know, I'm recommitting. That's good. He says, you know, and he says that famous crap, well, do 90 and 90. I'm going like, I did 90 and 90. He goes, do it again, because how'd it work last time? Well, it felt good at the end of it. He goes, do it again. And so for 2 years, I never missed a meeting. Mostly because I was afraid of what might happen if I didn't. I did not want to use anymore. I was willing to do whatever. You know, these guys come in, I'll do whatever you say. That was it for me, was to do that. Because when I started doing 90 and 90, I did not have wheels. I had to walk everywhere I went or get the bus. And I had no money. I had no job. So I had to just pretty much walk it. Then, you know, recovery kind of funny. Things start coming back together. You know, you start becoming employable again. You get a job and start making some money and stuff like that. And get a set of wheels, you know, and stuff. And I got a hoopty. It was a really, you know, $300 hell of a deal hoopty and stuff. But it would get me to my meetings, and that's all I needed at the time. And then I remember, you know, this ego and God. I was like, well, I need a new vehicle. And God answers, right? 3 days later, boom, the engine blows up. He did his part. Now I need to make it happen. And so that, you know, and I had this old truck that I went and got from Union Carbide in an auction. And that's what brought me to the meetings for the next 4 or 5 years. And it was funny that in this process, let's talk a minute about character defects. If you don't know what your character defects are, jump into a relationship and ask that other person. They will give you the list. So, that's basically what, you know, if I can't have my dope, then I will get my good feeling elsewhere. And I don't care if it's gambling, eating, spending, working, relationships, doesn't matter. I will get it somewhere. I'll fill it and stuff. And the deal is that there's just this big old huge hole. It's a God-sized hole in my spirit that is only filled with one thing, and everything else just leaves me hungry for more. So all of the people that I had relationships with in early recovery and stuff, God bless you and thank you. And you helped me, and I hope I helped you. And some are still alive, some aren't. And the thing is I didn't have a very good relationship with me. It wasn't very loving. It wasn't very tolerant. It wasn't very understanding. It was damn judgmental, and it was real critical, and it was real negative. And if that's what I brought to the table, maybe I should be respectful of other people enough to stay out of their lives for a minute until things got better. You know, and that's why when I get a sponsee, I always tell them, hey, it might be a good idea to wait until you're done with your sixth step before you start adding to you your tenth step and fourth step. Resentments and things that you did wrong that you can't undo. Things that you can't unsay and stuff like that. That at least take a look at your character defects so that you know what you bring to the table and that you can be honest with it. And so, and this is all a process. You know, by now I'm getting to about like 7 years clean or something. I'm fully involved in service. I tricked my original road dog into going into service. I just said, hey man, they give us sandwiches if we go here on this thing, you know, and stuff like that. And because I had to have somebody help me do service. And I thought, well, tricking them's good, you know, because if you just say, hey, I want you to come get involved in service, 3% of the people are, so that 97% of the people can complain, it doesn't sell well. And I was getting some relief from getting outside of just doing for me and helping me, that it seemed like I wanted to do better by helping someone else, and especially someone that I didn't even know or know was coming. And so I got to give all kinds of props to H&I. H&I came into the treatment center I was in, and I liked whenever those guys come and they would talk, and I'm like, oh, I can relate to this guy. I'm gonna find out where he goes to meetings. I'm gonna go to the meetings where he goes, and that's how H&I works. And so I started doing H&I 35 days after I got out of Riverside. I did have a sponsor because they wanted us to have one before we left. And most guys just go out and go, I need a sponsor, and they get your phone number, and then they go back to the counselor and I go, I got the sponsor. He's right, you know, there's, you know, I can go now. But I was actually calling mine. And that sponsor is not clean today. Okay. And that guy said, okay, you know, you're going to meet me over here. And we used to do a meeting just down the street from here, to the north of us, that was in a treatment center. And I remember thinking, I got nothing to say to these people. And he said, listen, you really can't fuck up a newcomer with anything you say. Their life is already hard enough, bad enough, and stuff like that, that you might help them without even knowing that that's what you're doing. And so I went to my first H&I, and all I could tell you was I've been clean for 35 days. I'm not sure that I'm going to make it to 60, but I am sure as hell going to try and stay clean because I like this better than what I had before. And I was told by my sponsor that if you take care of the days, the years will take care of themselves. That my job was to take care of today. And I remember that. So, because I'm an addict, right? As soon as I got that 30-day keypad, my plan is, when I get that glow in the dark, and I have a party, because that's the way I plan that shit, it's just automatically way ahead of what's real. And my sponsor knew that. And my sponsor did a whole lot of compassionate work with getting me to just be in today. And just getting me to do just the next right thing. And sometimes I'd call him up, twist it off, and I'd tell him my problem, and he'd go, okay, so now you know what the problem is. What's the solution? Well, I don't know. He goes, well, think about it and call me back. Write it down. And it was in that writing that I was finally able to unscramble some of the brain. I mean, it was moving a mile a minute, you know. And it was writing that helped slow that down. It was writing that started making reconnections and stuff. They, you know, if they just tell you writing's good for you, that doesn't attract an addict. And you don't get the relief until you start doing the stuff. Then magically it works. So I sat on a few, I did a few committee things with HACNA. I love doing registration, especially newcomer registration. Because we used to just give out hugs and passes to people. And I'm like a hug junkie now. And I didn't even want to be touched by people back then. But now I'm a hug junkie. And it was really cool. Because when you're giving somebody something for free, like a pass to a convention, they really don't usually hate you. Right? And that felt good. What's really good is whenever you see that person 5 years later doing the same thing you were doing, and glad they are, you know. They don't tell you that on H&I. They don't tell you that one day somebody's going to come up to you and say, hey man, I remember you 3 years ago. I've been clean almost 3 years now. I'm like, wow. You know. So, there's a lot of secrets in recovery. And now that I got 20 years, which a miracle, the one thing I remember is God's gift to me is to have a clean date. My gift to God is what I do with it. And I used to do dope any way I could, as hard and fast and long as I could, and I like to do the same with my recovery. You know, thank God they don't have NA fishing groups. Because I would spend a whole bunch of time out there. And I might miss some of the message. But I go, everything I do with other people in recovery. I mean, I go to concerts. I do all kinds of things. And I remember sitting in a room going, if I can't use dope, life is over. What the fuck? Might as well just end it all. What am I going to do now? And now, it's hard to pick through all the things to do to get the ones that just, this is when I got to do, this is when I got to do, this is when I got to do. Tuberkna, I went to the very first Tuberkna, and I have not missed a Tuberkna yet. And I don't plan on missing one. Hackna has always been a big deal because I didn't know how to party clean. I didn't know that people can get together, have a good time, and somebody doesn't go to jail. So that's why I do those things. Recovery by the Sea in Corpus. You know, there's certain ones, and the Frolic in the Woods that Esperanza area does, the San Antonio group, has an annual thing that's a camp out. I feel closer to my God when I'm out doing something outside of four walls. And there's a whole bunch of things in recovery to do that you get that. So I've gone over my 25 minutes, but I want to tell you that what I got here to NA with, I owe everything that I have to NA. Because what I got here, all I had was the clothes on my back, a lot of confusion, and that was it. And so everything that I've gotten since then has been a gift of recovery. And if I ever don't sound grateful for that, it's not because I'm not grateful, it's just because my ego's in the way of it for a moment. But I will tell you that this has been nothing but growth and love, and I finally can be a friend to people, and I can finally, if I say something, chances are I'm going to do it. Whereas it used to be, if I said that, that'd be the last thing you'd figure. And I remember my sponsor saying, grab a road dog and go to meetings. And I got to tell you, my road dog is sitting right here. And has been 19 years. You know. And I don't think anybody would have bet money that either one of us was going to stay clean. And sure as hell not together. So the last thing I'll tell you, my sponsor said, was the best revenge on people that don't believe in you is success. And sometimes that's just enough to keep me clean for a day. With that, I want to say I love you and I appreciate everybody being here, and thanks. Right on. Thank you.